Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 39, February 13th, 2007. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I'd like to remind everybody there are multiple ways to contact the podcast. The easiest is via email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com or at the website www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. There's also a voicemail of 206-600-5782. And then the postal address is Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065, and that's in the United States. Now, in the last podcast, I really emphasized the fact that I wanted to get lots of voicemails, and I also noticed a precipitous drop in the emails. So please don't interpret the fact that I want voicemails as mean I don't like emails. That's not true at all. If you don't want to leave a voicemail, still send a message. I love getting the feedback. It's what keeps me going and lets me know what you all think. So send the feedback one way or the other, on the web forum, by email, on the website, or voicemail. However you get it to me, please send it along. Also, there is the Frapper map that is on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. That's got hundreds and hundreds of people, and that is showing where a lot of the listeners are on. And we have listeners on basically every continent and dozens of countries. So I think that's fantastic. Thanks for everybody who listens and has gone to the Frapper map. And if you haven't, please go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on the Frapper map and add yourself to it, because I love seeing where everyone's from. Lastly, I do have a MySpace page at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast, and that's for those who are interested in connecting with the Thelema Coast to Coast site on the MySpace environment. So far, there's like 1,500 users, and there's always room for more, so feel free to go over and friend the Thelema Coast to Coast MySpace page, and I'll friend you back. Now, a recent project that I've started is a new Thelemic mailing list, or a, not so much a mailing list, an announcement list called Harilu. And this is a free mailing list that will go out once or twice a month with announcements about books, events, music, and other items of interest for the Thelemic community. And you can sign up for that at www.thelema.nu/Harilu. And that mailing list is really, it's an opt-in situation, and it's through a professional service, so your emails are not going to be sold or anything like that. And what I want to do is I just kind of want to make a more active way for people to know about what's going on, whether it be interviews on the podcast or new books coming out, new CDs coming out, events happening, things like on the last podcast, talk to Nicole Klagsbrunn about the Cameron art exhibit that she's doing. So I would be announcing things like that. And I'm also really interested in knowing what's going on. I'm plugged into a number of sources of information, but I'm certainly not plugged into them all. And so if your organization is doing an event, or you know of a new book that's come out, or want to spotlight an event, or some music, a new CD, or something that would be of interest to the Thelemic community, feel free to send me an email letting me know about it. And check it out and possibly include it on the mailing. So again, that is at www.thelema.nu/Harilu. And I will have a link to the show notes. So the first issue of Hurilu will be going out a few days after this podcast is released. So please stop over there and add yourself to the list. All right, so now we're going to do some listener feedback. The first is a voicemail from Clinton, and he's got some comments about the previous podcast.
Hey, John. My name is Clinton. I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland, and I would just like to say that I really enjoy your talks with Roger Williamson, and I went as far as to buy his Black Book of the Jackal, and I really liked it and have recommended it to a couple of friends. And in the last episode, you mentioned something about trying to acquire the Book of the Law in other languages. In a few days, I'll be heading over to Finland, and I think I'll try and pick you and I both up a copy there. And I'd just like to thank you for having such an excellent podcast. And 93.
Thanks very much for sending in the voicemail, Clinton. And I'm glad that the interview with Roger Williamson attracted you to go purchase his books, and that they were really interesting for you. I really like some of the stuff that Roger's doing. I like the way he's using fiction and short stories to present ideas. It's a little different than much of the nonfiction that is out there in the occult community. And also, yes, I'm very interested in a Finnish Liber-All. That is one of the international languages that I do not have of Liber-All. So please, once you have some details on that, let me know. All right, now we're going to go and do some emails from listeners. The first is from Steve. He says, Kare John, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. I've been listening to your podcast for a few months now, and I'm slowly making my way through all of the episodes. I haven't made it through all of them yet, however, so please forgive my ignorance if you've answered this question on a previous show. My question is, who is this Keith418, and why is he on every show? Why should I care about his opinions on magic, the OTO, or anything else for that matter, when I don't even know who he is? To me, he's just another guy on the internet with an anonymous name and lots of opinions. Thanks for taking the time to answer this question. Love is the law, love under will. Steve in Oregon. Well, Steve, Keith418 is a friend of mine and someone who's been practicing magic and in occultism for well over 20 years. He's got a lot of experience in a variety of areas in occultism, and I find his opinions interesting and informative, and so that's one of the reasons I have him on the show. There's not a lot of people out there who can articulate themselves as well as he can, nor have as strong of opinions or have the broad understanding that he does. I'm certainly interested in talking to other people who have such backgrounds, but so far I really haven't found that many people who can really step up to the plate and do what he can. So that's one of the reasons he's on there, and also it's kind of fun to have him on. It's kind of like a, I don't know if you listen to NPR, but there's a psychology show called The Infinite Mind. And at the end, there's this guy named John Hockenberry who does kind of his commentaries and talks about what's going on that particular episode. And in some ways, I kind of see Keith418 as kind of a John Hockenberry type situation. So that's why he's on every show, or almost every show. There are actually a number that he's not on, but he will be on this show. And so, I'm really interested in hearing from other people, but so far I have not run across many people who can articulate themselves as well as he can. And as far as why you should care, maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. That's completely up to you. If what he says makes absolutely no sense to you and he sounds like a raving idiot, well, then feel free to ignore him. But if what he says makes sense and has some applicability to your life and or your practice, well, then take a listen. It's completely up to you. We can't make anybody listen or take any advice or anything. That's totally for you to decide. You are the total arbiter of your understanding. So, take him for what he is. Take it with a grain of salt. And if he doesn't make any sense to you, feel free to dismiss him. All right. The next email is from a listener named Justin. He writes, Hello, John. Do it thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. First off, I wanted to tell you how much I, and I'm sure the whole of the occult community, truly appreciate your show and the effort that goes into producing it. I've been studying and practicing magic for 6 months now and have continually come upon the dispute within the magic Thelemic community as to Israel Regardi's importance in relation to Crowleyanity and magic altogether. I recall Keith 418 using the word butchered when describing Rigardi's editing of Magic Without Tears. Is it merely the century-old Golden Dawn feud that clouds people's feelings, or is there actually substance to these remarks? Here's possibly a show idea. Israel Rigardi in the relation to Aleister Crowley and the history before and after Crowley's death. Keep up the excellent work. Loves the law, love under will. 93, Justin. Well, thanks for the suggestion. I'll keep that in mind. I happen to agree with Keith 418 about Rigardi's editing of Magic Without Tears. It really is a butchering job. I have an original first edition Magic Without Tears, and there is a significant amount of material that has been removed from it. And unfortunately, there has been no edition since the original publication that has all of the material in an unexpurgated version. So the only way to get it right now is either buy a first edition for hundreds, if not over $1,000, or go to a very error-full version on the website hermetic.com, although that's better than nothing. As for the Rigardi-Crowley, Rigardi had a lot of issues with Crowley. They had a falling out, and, Rigardi had his stance on certain things about Crowley and or magic. In the last podcast, I had David Shoemaker reply about some of the Jungian ideas of seeing certain aspects of magic as psychological and so forth. And a lot of that does come from Rigardi and his interpretation of magic. And then Crowley, had some other interpretations about things. And so there are some disagreements about approaches, and there's probably also some personal animosity between Rigardi and Crowley, based on their relationship falling apart. So I don't think it's a Golden Dawn slash OTO thing. I think it's a lot more complex than that. I would encourage you to go check out the Magic Without Tears online and read Rigardi's biography of Crowley, as well as some of the other biographies that are out there, and kind of get a take of what Rigardi's stance on Crowley is and some of the other people, and then kind of make up your mind from there. So thanks for sending in the email, Justin. All right, the next one is from a listener named Odin. He's writing in regard to podcast 36, where we were talking about comic books. 93, John, first off, I'm a new listener to the podcast and love it. You're doing a great job, and now have one more religious listener. Ha ha. I was listening to podcast 36, and you talked to Christopher Knowles about a book he's working on about the connection between comic books and the occult. You mentioned Alan Moore and Grant Morrison, two of my favorite authors. However, your guest didn't mention specific places to start with these authors if listeners would be interested in reading some occult-related comics. The best place to start would be Alan Moore's Promethea, which he has described as a thinly veiled lesson in magic. The 31 issues in the series includes an issue explaining major arcana of the tarot and a series of 11 issues, which one devoted to explanation of the Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. It is a great series that also has some of the best art I've ever seen in a comic. Again, I love your show and keep up the great work. 93. Well, thank you very much, Odin. I appreciate you sending that in and letting us know. I can't say I'm very plugged into the comic books market, so this kind of suggestion is very useful. So thanks for sending that in, and I hope that's useful to the listeners. The last email is from a listener named Larry. He seems to have gone back to some of the older podcasts, in particular to the one that was done as an experiment I did where I was releasing the podcast as audio and or video, and I released the podcast as a Windows Media video file. And, of course, that is pretty much for Windows only, and so there's not a lot of options for Mac. But Larry emails in saying, listening to an older cast, and just let you know that Flip for Mac lets you watch Windows media files on OS X, so that should help your enhanced podcast. Cheers, Larry. So thanks for sending that in, Larry. And for those Mac OS X users, if you go and get Flip, you can download the Windows media version of an older podcast. I forget what number it is off the top of my head, but it was a discussion by Richard Kaczynski talking about the magical evolution of Aleister Crowley. So a very informative talk, and I encourage people to go check it out. And again, Larry, thanks for sending in that note. Okay, so that is the listener feedback for this show. Thanks to everyone who sent it in, and I would love to get more, whether it be voicemail or email or however you want to send it. Moving on to the show interviews. The first one is with Jerry Cornelius. He returns to the podcast to tell us about his new publication called Cornelia. Then I have a discussion with Keith 418. And then lastly, I have an interview with Lon Duquette regarding his latest books called Accidental Christ and The Key to Solomon's Key. So, without further ado, let's get into the interview with Jerry Cornelius.
We have on the phone with us Jerry Cornelius. Welcome to the podcast, 93.
Thank you, 93.
Now, recently you've come out with a new publication called Cornelia.
That's correct.
And this is a slight departure from your previous projects of The Red Flame. Can you first tell me why this publication came about, how it's different from The Red Flame, and even where the name is coming from?
Sure. Well, as everyone knows, Red Flame ran for almost 12 years. It was a long publication, but I didn't own it. That's one of the things a lot of people don't understand. It was actually owned by my ex-wife.
Okay.
And she officially closed it down in October of 2006.
Oh, okay.
But it was always our AA lineage. It was particular with our publication. And since then, we've had the need to sit back and have a publication or an arm for publishing different material.
Mm-hmm.
So that was partially the need of Cornelia. The other problem that we were faced with is the fact that in the last few years, we're getting hundreds of letters about inquiring about our AA branch.
Okay.
And thing is, we do not take on students. We're a very closed branch, unlike other branches.
Mm-hmm.
And we always wait till we have a one-on-one teacher available.
Okay. So in lieu of doing that, you're doing the publication?
Right. Because this basically meant because we have to wait for teachers, a lot of people are just waiting on the sidelines, more or less waiting for us. So we began Cornelia to reach a lot of these people who are outside of our branch but thirsting for teachings and information. And one of the things we realized is so many of them are asking the same exact questions over and over and over again. And so what we looked at with Cornelia, since our particular branch adheres strongly to only a three-grade system, the hermit, the lover, and the man of earth, Cornelia was decided they will give people the primary teachings as founded within our man of earth grade.
Okay.
So it was basically to lay the foundation. And we feel in this respect that if a person is unable to join our branch for whatever reason, at least they can study and continue on their own, read the information to see how our branch mutated and what we offer. And then success being the proof, you know, they can either join later on or whatever.
All right. Well, where did the name come from?
Well, Cornelia is something that's basically the utterance of a lot of my soul, because I do a lot of the writings of the publication as I did with Red Flame. So we were trying to kick around different names, and we decided Cornelia, being the Latin feminine of Cornelius, my last name, more or less represents the female, the utterance of the internal soul of Jerry Cornelius.
So this is kind of you outpouring your soul onto paper.
Yes, and being the head of the lineage and the actual major teacher and writer, we figured it was appropriate.
Okay. Well, when did this start coming out? I know you already have a number of issues.
Yeah, it came out on January 1st. And like Red Flame, we have absolutely no due dates. We're adamant against due dates.
Okay, so you're January 1st, 2007.
That's correct.
So
we found out with Red Flame and other publications previous that the more we were faced with due dates, our work got shabbier.
So
we wanted to research and do material and release it when we're ready. And with Cornelia, we've already got about 18, 19 issues that we're just waiting in the wings, because these are information that we've been handing to our Man of Earth students for a long time now.
Now, when you say 18 or 19 issues, planned issues or actually published,
done,
printed, done,
these,
ready
these
to go?
These are done.
Okay.
We're probably going to released about 2 a month, we're looking at.
Okay, so you're saying you have 18 done, but you haven't released them all yet.
That's correct.
Okay, so how many have you
released? Everybody at once, because people will cry.
Okay.
So we figured, give them a couple of issues each month, and let them chew on those.
Oh, okay, so as of February 2007, I guess about a month and a half since you've come out with it, how many issues have you published?
We just released our 4th issue.
Oh, okay. So are you going to be averaging maybe 1 or 2 a month for the next...
Well, definitely 1 a month. We're going to probably try to shoot for 2. That's what we'd like to shoot for. But a lot of it hinges on my health, because, as you know, I've been ill of late. And, who can come down and help me and assist me.
Okay.
So far, Cornelia's had great success within our lineage, and the reviews for it are excellent. We've released in there a lot of the private teachings and even some of the open papers that we've released,
mm-hmm.
basically explaining the history of the AA, how it mutated within our lineage, who Grady McMurtry is, and basically explaining us. This way people get to know us, more or less.
Okay.
We're running a lot of serials throughout the issues, too, so that each issue will have, as an example, the first issue would have Chapter 1 in the series of The Holy Guardian Angel, which is a lengthy series we have on what the angel is, how it mutated throughout history, how bad Crowley actually messed it up in theory, and trying to correct the premise. So that series runs throughout the issues.
All right. And then what format is it in?
Well, we wanted to print it originally like a magazine format, basically 8.5 by 11. And it's a stapled cover and Xeroxed insides. And we wanted to do that because we want to be able to punch holes in it, almost like lessons format. So it's not necessarily a flick magazine as much as if you look at it like lessons, whether it's like Amwork or Boda or other types, these are lessons to be, have to be put into a binder.
Okay.
And they average every issue is between 50 to 60 pages.
Oh, wow. So it's not...
It's not like a flimsy little issue.
Okay.
The other series that we're running throughout this Cornelia is one of the red flames that's most requested and most sought after is the Magical Essence of Aleister Crowley series.
And that was Red Flame number 7.
That's correct. And that was originally a series that we released in amongst our AA lineage that we decided to publish in a format. Of course, excluding lesson number 4 and a few other lessons, because we thought they really shouldn't be released.
But you're doing it in full in this one.
This one is from A to Z. We're not editing any of it.
Okay. Well, if somebody was interested in getting these, how would they get in touch with you to order them?
Well, we have our website, which is found at cornelius93.com, and we have our links to our publication. And there's also a link of an index page to the publication, because we have one entire page which lists every single content per issue. So if you want to sit back and see what we're doing, because there's a lot of different articles in each issue besides just the main ones.
Okay.
For instance, another series that we're releasing, I don't know if you remember the old Friends and Acquaintance of Aleister Crowley series?
Yes, that was Red Flame 3?
That's correct. We had to edit that for the size. And we had to omit something like 13 chapters and edit every single one down into the format to fit that old Red Flame format. We're going to go back now in this Cornelia and put the chapters that were omitted first, and then produce each and every single biography unedited.
Okay.
So every issue will also have one of these biographies. And we'll have articles in there by other AA members. There's articles in there by Philip Seckler. So it's going to have quite a bit.
Great. So people can go to the website. How much does each issue cost?
$8 a piece.
So $8 U.S.
Right.
And then shipping is in addition. $350
shipping and handling.
And that's for just the U.S. International would...
Yeah, for foreign orders, we request to contact us. Or they can contact Weiser's.
Okay.
Weiser's deals with foreign orders. They also carry Cornelia.
Okay, so Weiser Antiquarian does.
That's correct.
Okay, fantastic. So, and what was that website again?
For ours is cornelius93.com.
All right, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Okay.
And Is there anything else you want to let the listeners know about Cornelia?
Well, it's an interesting publication. I mean, it's offering a lot of information that people have been asking for a long time. And it's no secret that in the world today of Thelema, we're greatly lacking creative thought. And we hope to actually fulfill that and give some people some ideas to chew on.
Well, definitely Red Flame, you know, they went like hotcakes. Oh, that reminds me. How many of each issue are you going to publish? Is there a limit?
No, there will be absolutely no limit to this.
So as long as there's orders, you'll keep publishing?
As long as there's orders for this, we will fill them.
Okay. Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. 93
now. Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank Jerry for coming onto the podcast and letting us know about Cornelia. And it's great to see him continually working to put out new material and be creative in the Thelemic community. And I would love it if more people could do the same. So let's move on to the discussion with Keith418. In the last podcast, as I mentioned earlier, David Shoemaker made some comments about psychology, and then even earlier in this podcast, talked about regarding his psychological approach. Well, I talked with Keith418 about Freudian psychology and the father figure, and Keith418's recent writings and readings about Freudian psychology and its application to magical practice. So here's my discussion with Keith418.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John, thanks for having me.
In your blog recently, you've done a number of posts referencing Freudian psychology, Philip Reif, and his take on Freud. And you're kind of looking at masculine figures or a father figure. For the listeners who haven't had a chance to read your blog, can you give a little background on this subject?
Well, I was tired of all of the sort of attempts to conflate psychology and magic that's sort of common in the occult community, especially among middle-class people who sort of want to see magic rendered in terms that's like the most safe and the most accessible to them and their values. So rather than like the kind of crazy-making dangers of someone screaming at the walls in a room by themselves trying to invoke spiritual entities, they sort of try to render everything in the occult community as some expression of some sort of depth psychology or Jungian therapy. And it gets really tiresome and really lame. And I think I've also sort of gotten fed up with the way the therapeutic culture, the larger therapeutic culture in the United States in particular, has sort of entered into the OTO and occult communities in general in an attempt to cast everything in this sort of, oh, you know, you've got problems and we're here to help you kind of therapeutic modality of looking at everything. And I just got fed up with it. So I decided, taking Crowley's advice in Tian Tao to mind, to go and look at Freud and the early therapists, other people like Otto Rank, for example, to see, you know, what their real original take was. And lo and behold, I discovered some really great material, some really great stuff that, of course, is not at all part of the modern therapeutic environment in the United States because it's scary and unhappy-making, and it's full of dark urges and sort of the deep depths of human drives of aggression and lust and all the things that Americans in particular really don't want to spend a lot of time looking at or examining anymore. So I was looking in particular at the way Freud describes the features of libidinal energies and the way they basically inform a lot of the way we deal with and look at the world. And magic, and tantric magic in particular, deals with addressing, knowing, controlling those same libidinal energies. So I think Freud, unadorned, pretty much, and sort of the kind of Freud that most people want to get away from has a lot to teach us, and especially has a lot to teach magicians and tantricists, because he lays a lot of it on the line. And, you know, I've been gratified in that some of my friends and readers have looked at this material and said, yeah, this is great stuff, this is really helpful, this is good. And it sort of is a way to kind of, I guess, redeem the psychological input that we're getting that's not that good, and sort of turn it around and say, hey, what does this stuff really have to teach us, and what's the unhappy-making, hurtful, difficult, but nonetheless revealing material in it? So in terms of looking at the primal father, I mean, you have to go to one of Freud's most controversial, if not his most discredited books, which is Totem and Taboo, where he talks about the origins of the family and of all of human society in the primal horde. which is ruled over by a primal father that Freud explicitly casts as being like Nietzsche's Overman.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you look at the influence that this character has, the more it seems sort of like an Adam figure, maybe even a Moses in certain senses, in that it's a magician. It's putting its stamp on the community. It's got its own harem, which you know you could look at as its own sanctuary of initiates and concubines that it's working its magic through. And so there, I think, are a lot of sexual magic connections to what Freud is describing as the primal family. And when we look at this, we can say, okay, does the magician, in a certain sense, aspire to return to this sort of primal father where he puts his stamp on the world and he controls the universe through his sexual energy and through his domination genetically as well as magically? What is that really about? How is that determined, and where does that really come from? So, again, I mean, I think that's something that gives people a lot of things to think about.
Well, in one of your posts, you were saying that when people see this kind of this primal father or this, I guess, kind of like this overman, this leader, they're strangely attracted to him because he has something that they're lacking, like this vitality, this
right,
other
and
aspect.
And, exactly.
But the other thing he has is no concern for the other. He's completely self-confident and self-capable. He doesn't need the approval of the group.
Right. And he seduces people in the group either through a sort of purity of aspiration, which you know entices people and intoxicates them, and also through a strength of will and purpose, which is greater than their own. I mean, in these sorts of situations, people are coming from their own position of wills that have been completely collectivized. They can't put themselves first. They can't prioritize their own needs and values. And, you know, we see this in the OTO with people who can't kind of separate their own personal agenda out from the group. And then they see somebody who's completely independent and has this sort of erotic domination over others, either through the purity of their own aspiration or because they represent, in Nietzschean terms, a higher being, who at the same time often seems immoral. I mean, Nietzsche points out that real pagans in his own philosophy posits higher beings who are beyond good and evil and therefore immoral. And not amoral, he says immoral, which I think is a significant distinction because people try to get around that, but that's really what he's saying. So this darkly, you know, seductive character has a kind of effect on followers, and there's a, you know, almost an erotic submission of their will to this person, and all political leaders, to a certain extent, exert this kind of libidinal fascination over their followers, and this is, you know, something that Freud thought really informed all group psychology, and so we can start analyzing occult groups and occult histories to see, are there really strong libidinal connections between the leaders and the followers and between the followers and each other? And what's fascinating to me about this is that magic, like Freudian psychoanalysis, makes an attempt to sort of make this libidinal connection obvious. And gnosis is, in a lot of ways, coming to a realization of how it's really there. And so in both magic and Freudian analysis, there's an attempt to make this latent, secret, libidinal fire or primal connection obvious. And gnosis is when you come to the knowledge of that, and it's sort of similar to psychoanalysis. The difference is that I think Crowley really sought at one point to master this force and to explain it scientifically and to study it, whereas I think at a certain crucial point, psychoanalysis turned away from that. They sort of retreated away from embracing that that pure libidinal energy and saw it as being two-sided. There's a threatening element to it, there's an aggressive element to it, as well as a profoundly beautiful one. And that, to me, is where you start looking at real gods who have both light and dark sides to them. And most of the time, people just want God to be, or the higher beings to be good, and like Mr. Rogers, who love them just the way they are, and this is their, you know, their desire. But instead, the more political figures, I think, are like this, the more they lose that essential libidinal energy.
Right. It just seems the same thing with God. I mean, even if you look at Judeo-Christianity, I mean, the original God of the Jews was the God who made good and who made evil, who did,
right,
you know, great things for the people and also punished them, you know,
right,
mercilessly because they did not follow the commandment or whatever.
Right.
Whereas the God of today is all love and happiness and joy and is easy to forget about because there's just no...
Right, and it's not sexy. I mean, this is the thing that Freud, I think, would say about why fundamentalist churches, and Crowley points this out, too, in the commentaries, as you know, that fundamentalist Christian churches that are unafraid of presenting the dark side of God, the judgmental side, the side that most, you know, liberal humanists don't like, are the ones that get people going. You know,
right,
that's the ones that get people's enthusiasm because that libidinal energy is there.
Right.
It dissipates.
Phelps is right up there. I mean, he's got, like, virtually no following, but he's so full of energy and he's so out there that,
right,
that people pay attention.
Right. Exactly. And that, you know, that primal father is in a lot of ways the primal force, the primal embodiment of this libidinal tantric energy that's in magic. And a lot of people, you know, are worried about what that force is going to get up to. And they have every right to worry about it because it is inherently threatening and destabilizing and apocalyptic. Too bad.
But but the way you describe it, it very much sounds like that's where Crowley was trying to get people to be. He was trying to get, you know, the kings to be that kind of person, to
sure,
embrace the good and the bad, to be amoral. To,
right,
to not need the other and to be self-satisfied and self-confident. And
well, look at his critique of morality that runs, you know, explicitly throughout the commentaries and in other places. He's very upfront about it. I think at one point he says, you know, to hell with the moral principle. It makes men cattle. And you can find that line in the unedited commentaries on the Book of the Law. And this is, of course, the thing that, you know, frightens a lot of people in the OTO. They don't like that because they're trying to keep some sort of morality on top of the will, to keep it from getting up to naughty things. And that's, as soon as they do that, they sort of cut off the energy and it stops being interesting.
Right. So it's the same thing where he says, you know, most people are cattle and and the kings should not be afraid of using them for their mutton and wool.
Right. Well, they have that collectivized will that Freud is pointing to, that they're not ever going to be able to escape their fears and their need for reinforcement from others. And again, this is sort of, to me, where Freud and Nietzsche hook up together and seem very similar. And of course, this is not what, you know, I think the dominant psychoanalytic model is in the United States anymore, because it's seeking, you know, to avoid these unhappy-making kind of ideas.
So where do you see this going? Do you see this kind of creating kind of a bifurcation within groups? You have those who are attracted to the individual who has this self-confidence, this libidinal energy that is attractive to others, and then those who are attracted to it. Is that, you know, where you see the Thelemic community breaking up, you know? Or,
well, it could happen that way. I mean, I think it helps people to look at their own relationships, and especially in guru yoga. If you've been attracted to a guru, if you've worked with a guru, if you've submitted to guru yoga and really tried to work it, you have to look at the libidinal component that's there. And some of my teachers have pointed back to Plato's Symposium, where Alcibiades, in the course of that dialogue, reveals that it's Socrates' purity that attracts him. That Socrates is seen as a pure individual who ultimately the purity of his own aspiration is the thing that draws Alcibiades to him. And studying that particular document shows how guru yoga really works in a lot of ways. So I would recommend that people think about that. You know, again, Crowley himself was definitely one of these seductive, dark powers who seduced people with his you know, erotic domination, and I think this is one of the things that people complained the most about him about when he was alive, was that he was going around doing this to people. And there will be people in the OTO who are more or less successful in imitating him when it comes to this. The problem is often that they just sort of do it for its own sake. I mean, this is kind of my critique of the Temple of Set. It's a hierarchical satanic organization that exists to be a hierarchical satanic organization. It's, at least it seems that way to me, that there's the higher purpose there doesn't always seem easily grasped. Whereas, you know, if you just want to go around and form your own little Charlie Manson cult, we've seen a lot of people do that too, and it doesn't last very long. It has to be part of a larger aspiration, a larger sort of agenda. And That's really what's going to make something work in the long run, not these sorts of little cults of personality, which I think you and I have observed over the time that we've been involved in the occult community. They come and go.
Yes, very much. I've also noticed kind of a correlation here. If a leader emerges because he has this libidinal energy that people are attracted to, the converse is if he loses it, he'll lose the attraction. He'll lose his followers.
Sure. Yeah, people will not be turned on anymore, and they'll go looking for something that will turn them on.
I think that's happening in a lot of cases in the OTO right now.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think it's too bad, but I think it's part of what's going to happen if, you know, the leadership of the organization is sort of dedicated to this middle-class church idea of, you know, sort of Gnostic Presbyterianism where, you know, everybody comes in and it's very sedate and, you know, it's not very sexy to people. I mean, look at the recent Magical Link. Is that really a sexy, challenging document? Or
you mean
Agape?
The Magical Link? Agape.
The Agape, right. And this is sort of my kind of concern, is that when the OTO or when any magical group stops being sexy, people will go looking for one that is. And that, to me, is kind of the issue. Is it really invested in continuing this sort of libidinal energy, or is that energy too threatening to the pre-existing values of the people who are in it, and are they sort of working to undermine their own libidinal authority and their own power in that sense? And I've often seen that be the case, but I could be wrong.
What was the name of that book that you were reading again?
I'm reading right now Freud, The Mind of the Moralist by Philip Reif. The Freud text that I recommend people looking at to start out with is Totem and Taboo, which I think is really important in terms of Tantra, Freud's book on group psychology, and The Future of an Illusion, Civilization and Its Discontents. That has a lot about religion in it and Freud's take on that. A lot of the Freud is a lot easier to read than people think. I was really surprised because I'd read him in college, and I didn't really remember how easy he was to understand and how simple a lot of the ideas were just to read. They have complex, you know, follow-up, but it's not a trial to read these books. You don't need to have a sort of dumbed-down version of Freud handed to you. You can actually just read the original text. You don't need some cheesy, you know,
beginner book
guide.
Right.
Don't want to insult any of your other guests, but, you know.
I understand. Well, thanks again. I'm glad you came on to let people know about this, and
it's,
I hope
it's
it...
an interesting direction. I mean, it's a direction I think that it might be rewarding for folks to look at.
Yeah, and especially since, you know, recently we've had a number of people talk about psychological aspects of magic. You know, this is a completely different take on it. So I think that's great.
Right. Well, my desire always is to bring up the most unhappy making truth possible.
Well, maybe you've done that here. Maybe not. We'll have to see what people say.
Okay.
Thanks again. 93,
John.
I want to thank Keith for being on the podcast again. I always find his segments interesting and challenging, so I hope people enjoy them. Lastly, we're going to move on to the interview with Lon Duquette. He has recently released a new book called Accidental Christ, and the one previous to that was called The Key to Solomon's Key. Both are now available. The Accidental Christ is a hardcover, and The Key to Solomon's Key is a paperback. This interview was recorded about a week and a half ago. I had anticipated releasing this podcast just at the beginning of February, but due to a number of circumstances, it was delayed. So some of the references that Lon makes to some of the events that he's doing is because I was anticipating releasing this sooner. So unfortunately, some of them have passed. But Duquette is still doing a number of talks through the year. So I will have a link to his website, and you can go there to find out his schedule. So either way, here is Lon Duquette talking about his books, Accidental Christ and The Key to Solomon's Key.
We have on the phone with us Lon Duquette. Welcome to the podcast, Lon. 93,
John.
Now, you've been busy lately having a few books. Your most recent book to be released is The Key to Solomon's Key. And then you also have a book coming out in the next week called Accidental Christ. Let's start with The Key to Solomon's Key, since that's out.
Okay.
What is that book about in general?
That book is I wanted to start with, you know, The Lesser Key of Solomon, and give sort of an extended commentary on Goetia and such. That was my original intent. But as I started to develop the book, I started to explore the character of King Solomon, because this is Solomonic magic after all. And I joined the Masons about 8 years ago, and I enjoy being a Mason. It's an okay thing. I really appreciate it, you know, now after 30 years of bopping around the occult world. Masonry is pretty interesting, even though my older Masonic brothers, don't appreciate certain aspects of it. I certainly got a kick out of it, and it's been rewarding for me as a magician to be a Mason. And King Solomon is a big guy in Masonry, so I, in an attempt to sort of focus more on the archetypal character of Solomon, I started to dig around, and I really wanted to have some little historical references about Solomon. And I Googled around like you do nowadays, and I found a whole lot about Solomon, but I didn't find anything about him historically. And when I started to dig more into the historical aspect of it, I was not only coming up empty, but what I was finding was not only a lack of archaeological evidence of the existence of King David and King Solomon, but an abundance of archaeological evidence that would indicate something. Other things were going on at that mm-hmm. time period, and that other people were living there in that area. So I started to sort of piece together a very big, very general picture of what Masonry does and what Masonry obliges her members to meditate on and to think about. And I was starting to put two and two together, because Solomon's a big guy in Masonry, but nowhere in Masonry, are we obliged to accept the Bible stories as history. As a matter of fact, it's almost ironic. We're caused to think about Bible stories, but then we're immediately obliged to think about those same characters, outside of the strict, Bible narrative. And so I was putting two and two together and coming up with fives and sixes and sevens, I was closing in on a four, And Masonry's veneration of the Knights Templar is another very sort of curious thing. And, there's all this speculation of, what did the Templars find? Did they find the foreskin of Jesus? Did they find the head of John the Baptist or the Ark of the Covenant? And all of this stuff that nobody can prove. Nobody, there's no, real evidence that they had something. But, nine guys, billeted at that area where King Solomon's temple was supposed to have existed at one time. And they were billeted there for 9 years. Whether they were excavating or not, who knows? But you'd think they'd at least want to poke around. And, it started to look like, the Templars didn't have to have any specific information other than the fact that most of the Old Testament narrative is entirely fictional.
Right, and as I was reading this, at first I thought that was kind of your secret, was that there was no real David, or there was no real Solomon. But that's not really kind of the secrets that you're, or the key that you're talking about in here.
No, the key is more of a spiritual and a magical key, and Solomon, the character of Solomon, I believe provides that key. It's sort of the magical persona that a successful magician of any ilk needs to accomplish. I guess the big secret is that we need to be Solomons.
Mm-hmm. And so, without revealing your keys in here, I guess the key after you go through and kind of weave this tale of Solomon and the Templars and Goetic workings and masonry and all that together, the keys are in the end of how to kind of become a Solomon yourself.
Right. It's the self-transformational aspect of it. And in my opinion, Masonry has sort of quietly, in a very understated, in a very respectful way, Masonry has for the last 300 years, more or less obliged her initiates to meditate on this secret, and for those who have eyes to hear and ears to see, but it doesn't shove it down their throats, But like I say, I came into Masonry after 30 years of esoteric study, and certain things, very broad concepts within the traditions, initiations of Masonry, just were as clear as day. These guys were telling me there's more to this Bible narrative. There's more. There's more history. There's more spiritual technique and theory and such. And it, Masons just love the Bible. The Bible is on the altar and stuff. And me, I'm not a. The Bible's not my holy book.
Right.
Okay. And the way they use the Bible is so incredibly unique. The Bible passages that they stress and that they focus on are those very, very same things that if you would investigate that area of the Bible, of course you would come up with the fact that there was, in all likelihood, no King David, no King Solomon, no ancient Israel, as we, as Cecil B. DeMille, would suggest that there was. Not only that, but they actually focus in on parts of the Old Testament narrative that do give you a clue of where this all came from, what the real birth of Judaism and such really was. The York Rite of Masonry and certain degrees of the Scottish Rite really focus on this return of the Jews from captivity in Babylon.
Mm-hmm, the diaspora.
Yes, and they go to great lengths to make you meditate, to make you consider this this story. And in, I don't know, I was raised a Methodist, and this part of the Old Testament was never mentioned. It was like new stuff. But what it appears to, what the Masons are appearing to hint at is that this period of time, around, 586 or 530 B.C., this was the actual birth of Judaism as we know it. This is when the Bible was written. This is when, so the return of various cultures that Nebuchadnezzar had captured and taken back to Babylon to Babylonianize, the royalty and the elite of all the little areas that he conquered. Once Cyrus took over Babylon, he just wanted to get rid of these people, and there was only one place that was handy that wasn't already ruled by a king or defended by an army, and that was the Palestine area, and so it appears that they literally made up a religion to unite several groups of people, maybe 12 groups of people.
mm-hmm.
And give them a religion and relocate them in a place that was relatively undefended by, an organized country or group of its own. And if we think that this is too weird, if we think that this is too far-fetched, we can just look to a little over 100 years ago at what the Mormons did.
You mean by going out to Utah and just starting out fresh there?
Yes. Well, they found themselves a prophet. They moved to an area that was undefended, and set up a religion and a country or a state.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And in a lot of ways, that they are kind of a state within a state.
Indeed, they are.
So, yeah, that's something that we might look at. And also, it's not so far-fetched, too, when you think about the fact that, just a little over, a little under 70 years ago, all of a sudden, Israel was remade out of nothing again.
There you go.
So maybe that's not so far-fetched.
Well, and I try to make the point because, none of us can actually go back... back in time and really, know with any certainty what happened, even a couple years ago in time. But the point I'm trying to make in the book is even if this scenario that I'm suggesting wasn't historically true, and we don't have evidence, of all of this, neither did the Templars, neither did the Crusaders, neither did the Western civilization. And even if the whole thing was absolutely true, and maybe we'll find archaeological evidence of, King Solomon's, condom wrapper or something, up until now, we've had no true evidence to suggest that. And let's say the Templars, that was part of the Templar a secret, part of the leverage that they had over the church, even if it wasn't historically correct, and even if we find out in the future that was all wrong, at least for the last 2,000 years, there was no evidence to suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the church didn't know it either. So it. I try to be as respectful as I can to people's religion and such, but it truly appears that the church, the Old Testament, and if you pull out Solomon and David, you pull the plug on the Messiah credentials of Jesus, too.
Right, because Jesus is in the house of David.
Correct. So it really would be a big secret. It would be a big piece of information. And it certainly would have made things complicated for the church in the 12th century, which was, literally trying to rule the world.
Right. No, they were trying to make an ecclesiastical Roman Empire.
Correct.
Now, in your book, you not only do you talk about all these things, but you also go into some detail about the Galatia. You give kind of the conjurations and the basic outline of a ritual and the seals and the descriptions of the 72 demons that make the Shem Hamphorosh. And with your book, do you think that this is enough information that somebody could sit down and do the work and actually do Goetic invocation?
Yeah, I think there's more than enough information for them to do that, but that's my own personal magical view. I think if you know what the formula is, that of how the magician prepares, and in a way the my little prologue to the Lesser Key of Solomon excerpts there was to stress this inner preparation that the magician goes through, it could be done even easier, even more straightforward, even more modern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the excerpts from the Lesser Key of Solomon that I've placed there are more suggestive as to what the formula is, rather than you have to practice this letter perfect just like this in order to make it work.
Right. Your circle doesn't have to exactly be 9 feet, or does there even have to be a circle?
Well, there has to sort of be what is the circle in reality, okay? Mm-hmm. And you could take that as subtle as the magician's own strong aura.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you need a some tape on the floor, or do you need a wooden circle, or do you need a canvas carpet? You know, you don't. But you do have to have what the circle means, that doesn't necessarily have to mean a physical circle. As far as the names on the circle, you know, excuse me, I appreciate Kabbalistically, you know, all of those names and what what they mean, but I can, in a more simple manner, with fewer names and such, accomplish exactly the same thing. So even though I put, you know, a lot of the excerpts from the Lesser Key of Solomon, I'm doing so in the book just to stress what the formula is, and hope that every magician that wants to embark on this kind of magic truly would devise their own. That's not to say that your own magic art, because magic is an art, just like painting and dance and music. If it is important to the magician's sense of art to do things exactly as he or she thinks was done by ancient magicians or medieval magicians, then of course do that. Go to great lengths to use the right inks and do things at the right time. And if it's important to the magician's sense of art to be a classic traditional Goetic magician, then by all means do it. But if your sense of art is more free form, you can do exactly the same thing just by observing what the basic formula of evocation is.
Well, let's move on to your newer book. That's Accidental Christ. That's published by a different company. CCC Publishing did your Key to Solomon's Key. And a newer company named, is it Thelema Aura or Thelemic Aura?
Thelema Aura.
Thelema, yes. Aura is coming out with your Accidental Christ this week, actually, on February 25th.
January 25th.
Oh, I'm sorry, January 25th. I wrote,
yes,
that down wrong. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay, and what is that about? I mean, you kind of talked a bit in your Key to Solomon's Key about, the Bible and its kind of different take within the Masonic ceremonies. What is your Accidental Christ about?
Well, I'll tell you a little story. Accidental Christ is a novel, and it's the first time I've, you know, explored fiction. And but I was in the shower about 15 years ago. I've taken several since then. But I was in the shower, and for some reason, you know how your mind wanders when you're in the shower?
Sure.
And for some reason, I was thinking about the story of Jesus turning water into wine. Now, that story is only found in the book of John.
Mm-hmm.
And the book of John is in many quarters is considered kind of the most mystical.
Right.
And
certainly the most Gnostic of the Gospels.
Yeah. And that story of the wedding at Cana, where he turned the water into wine, and that was his first miracle, by the way, and I guess that's what got me thinking. It was his first miracle, and it says right there in John that after he did that, then he became famous. Then people believed on him, I think is the term. And so that, you know, it's a pretty important miracle. And the other gospels just completely leave it alone. And so I was in the shower, and I figured out, I thought I figured out how he did it, or how the person in the story did it. Whether there was a, you know, a historical Jesus or not, we don't know that either. But anyway, it was a goofy little scenario of how he could have done it, and still dripping wet, I went and got my Bible that I got in the Methodist church when I was 11, and I looked it up, and I read the narrative just as it was. Just as it appears there, and I go, yes, this is how it could have happened. And it's very funny. It's a goofy thing, okay? But keeping in mind, you know, all of the sort of new speculation on Jesus, not just as a son of a poor carpenter, but Jesus is truly the character who was the true heir to the throne of David, okay? Because other Gospels go to great lengths to prove that, just like, you know, Prince Charles in England, Jesus was literally heir to the throne of King David. And there's all this speculation about, you know, that there was a true revolution and such, and all of this is background information, made my little story make sense. So I tell people in class, hey, I figured out how Jesus turned water into wine. And I tell them the story, and they all laugh, and they go, God, yes, that's exactly what, you know, the little story was a big hit, you know, just among my local friends here. And so I said, okay, I'm going to make a short story out of this. But in order to make that short story, I had to develop characters and make the historic or the new view of the historic atmosphere of Palestine during those years. I had to set that up. I had to set up, you know, the Jesus character as a person who he might have been a great teacher, might have been a great healer, and such, but he was also, you know, getting prepared to, you know, take over as the king, take Herod's throne away, literally. And by the time I'd set all of that up, so I could drop the shoe, you know, about what happened at this wedding, it was too long for a short story and too short for a novel.
So you had a little novella there, and you needed to do something with that.
Right. And so I thought, well, I'm going to put this aside for a while. But, you know, they always sort of hung around in the back of my mind. And you know, I had other books to write and such over that time period. But then I started to take on the ideas of the other miracles, the walk on water and the, you know, the loaves and fishes and the raising of Lazarus. And one by one, this Jesus character and his relatives and his co-conspirators sort of took on a life of their own. And you know, when I had time, I worked on the book. And finally, you know, finally it was long enough to be a novel. And you know, I tweaked on it and worked on it for a couple more years, and it's just sort of sat there. And then when the Thelema Ora people were asking me if I had anything that might be suitable for publishing, I said, no, I just got this novel, you know, that everybody's got a novel.
Yeah, but you got yours published.
I got, yeah. Well, I said, well, I sent it to them, and they went, wow, this is really cool, let's do it. And so there it is.
So this is also the inaugural book for them.
It is. It is. And you know, in a way, it's what a lucky time, you know, for a writer, anyway, to be the inaugural book of a publisher that really has a vision and the resources. So I'm very, very lucky. It's a beautiful, a hardbound edition, and they went to they spared no expense. They got this wonderful artist, Japanese artist that does what's called sumi-e. The minimal black brush strokes.
Yes.
Kind of art. And she's got about 12, 14. Every chapter is headed up by one of these incredibly beautiful pieces of art. And their editor was fabulous. And the company is in... it's a U.S. company, but the editorial and other offices are in Japan.
Oh, okay.
So it was they've been very, very supportive of the project, because kind of this is their inaugural piece, and they've got a bunch of other titles in the works. So I was just lucky to be the first one.
Very cool. Do you have anything else that you're working on right now or promoting?
Yeah. Well, I'm finishing up an Enochian book that I've been working on for about 3 years now, and we should see that in 2008. And
is that going to be coming out through Salima Aura or Red Wheel Weiser or a different?
That'll be a Weiser. That's a Weiser.
Okay.
Title. And I'm sort of excited about that, because the last few years here at my Monday Night Magic class, we've been exploring the earlier D material, the earlier part of their relationship, where the Holy Table and the Sigillum and the Lamen and the ring and that stuff was happening. And not that I don't think that Enochian magic is as developed by the Golden Dawn and Crowley doesn't work really well just right out of the box. It really does. But I got to thinking that before that Enochian material came to Dean Kelly, they'd had about 3 years of other kinds of magic, other kinds of angelic communication. And even though we don't have enough real good material, or no one has at least addressed that material to develop a fantastic magical system like they have the Enochian stuff that came toward the end, still I think that Dee and Kelly were being prepared. They were being mutated, if you will, by their experience during those two or three earlier years.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've tried to accomplish with the new Enochian book is to, without going back and truly reinventing the wheel, of those earlier preparation periods, help utilize the Holy Table, utilize the Lamen, the ring, utilize the the dynamics of those bits of magical furniture to help prepare the magicians for stock magical Enochian work. So if it works really good out of the box right now, how much better could it work if you prepare yourself a little bit like Dee and Kelly did? I guess that's the bottom line.
And what kind of results have you had with that so far?
The results have been very, very dramatic. And that's why I'm so excited about the book. It's been dramatic in a visionary way. The members of my class are more or less Enochian veterans, for the most part. It's been sort of a supercharge effect to to their visions. But what's really exciting is I've more or less taken this I've taken this show on the road, and I've done seminars all over the country the last 2 years, where I literally say it's a three hour seminar, and some of these people are just right off the street.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I give about 90 minutes of background and, you know, history and preparation and stuff, but the rest of it is just real roll up your sleeves visionary magic that utilizes the letters on the holy table in a Tibetan like chant and such, and the effects are tangible. I mean, it's better than hashish. So I've had very, very good results, and some of that material is part of the book too. So, and it's a different kind of magic, Enochian book. So,
well, great. Now, other than the books, you've done DVDs, you've got a CD out. You're also doing kind of talks and appearances. Or are you appearing anywhere anytime soon?
You know, there was a, yeah. I'm going to be at what they call the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles. Just on, I think it's January 6th. But it's
You mean February?
Yeah, excuse me, February.
Okay.
My turn. and I'm going to talk about the, you know, secret societies, you know, the Knights Templars, the Masons, and this more or less based on the Solomon Key thing, which is kind of surprising because I'm the you know, probably the, from their point of view, the wildest character there. I mean, they've got Arianna Huffington is going to talk. Dennis Kucinich and
so this also has kind of a political aspect to it too.
Yeah, it's sort of politically new age political progressive kind of thing. And you know, I'm going to have to buy a new pair of shoes to show up at this.
And are you going to be there promoting Accidental Christ?
Yeah, I'll be promoting Accidental Christ and the Key of Solomon's Key. Also, I'm going to be at INATS, you know, the International New Age Trade Show.
Oh, okay, right.
In Orlando. And that I'm just going to do like next week. I mean, I'm going in on February 1st, and I think I'm going to be promoting everything.
Big table spread out of everything.
I mean, it's going to be all on all the time. I've got going to promote the Key of Solomon's Key and Accidental Christ, and they've roped me in to read people's tarot cards for 2 hours at the New Leaf booth.
Oh, so, right.
And on Friday, I'm going to be at the Avalon Bookstore in Orlando to talk about the magic of Aleister Crowley.
Okay, great. Wow, they are keeping you busy.
They really are, and I'm trying to... Well, they're doing this while I'm still young and beautiful.
Sounds good. All right. Well, cool. This sounds like you've got a lot going on and a whole bunch of new books coming out. The you know, the Key to Solomon's Key was definitely interesting, and you know, like I said earlier, as I was reading it, I was like, "So is the key that is it this?" And then I read more, and I was like, "Oh no, it's not that." And and then, you know, I got to the end, and I was like, "Oh, I see. Okay, it's kind of putting all of these little things together." Okay.
Oh, I'm so glad you got it.
So yeah, and I'm very interested in seeing Accidental Christ. Now we talked about this earlier. One lucky listener of the podcast is going to get an autographed copy from you.
Absolutely, of Accidental Christ.
All right. So what people will need to do is just email podcast at Thelema Coast to Coast, and in the subject put Lon Duquette book, and put your address in there, and one person will be randomly chosen, and Lon himself will send you the book.
Yeah, as soon as I get one in my hot
Exactly. So maybe a few weeks, but yes.
Okay.
But great. I really appreciate you being on the show again, and I'm excited that things are really working out well for you. And
well, thank you.
And I hope to have you on the show again in the near future.
Well, I hope you do.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks again. 93.
Okay, John. 93.
I want to thank Lon, Jerry, and Keith for being on the podcast. And I especially want to thank the listeners who have sent feedback in, given suggestions, and let me know things. That's how I really know how the podcast is going. Also, I've mentioned this before, I also have a blog that's at www.thelema.new, and this is where I occasionally write about things about the OTO, Thelema, and my ideas about magic and practice and things like that. So if you, in between the podcast coming out, want to go and read a little about that, feel free to go to thelema.new and participate in the discussions. Also, I would like to thank paganradio.net. Paganradio.net rebroadcasts the Thelema Coast to Coast shows every Wednesday night. So I encourage everybody who wants to go and listen to some great music streaming, go to paganradio.net and take a listen there. It was some really good stuff. It also has a number of other pagan or occult-related podcasts that are broadcast on there, too. As I've mentioned before, Thelema Coast to Coast has some bumper stickers, and these are free to anybody who sends a postcard. It can be a postcard of anything, a postcard of your own creation, or just something that you've picked up at any place, and send it to Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065 in the USA, and I will send you a Thelema Coast to Coast bumper sticker. It's a it's red and white and black and has the Thelema Coast to Coast logo on it, and you can see a picture of it on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Now, I've received probably in the last month or two about half a dozen cards, and I need to get those in the mail or get the bumper stickers in the mail, so I apologize to the people who have sent those. And also, I'll be scanning them and putting up the pictures on Thelema Coast to Coast's website, and I do that with all the postcards. Lastly, in the last podcast, as Clinton mentioned, I'm interested in picking up international versions of Liberal. I have a number of languages already, including Polish and Swedish and a few other ones, but I'm interested in picking up some in all the other languages that are out there, so I could use some listener help in that. I'm certainly not asking them to be given to me free. I'm more than happy to work with the logistics of anybody out there to get them purchased and sent to me. But I need your help to know what is available in what languages and how to get it. So if you could email me and let me know, I'd greatly appreciate it. And one more reminder about the free giveaway that I discussed with Lon Duquette. He'll be giving away a copy of Accidental Christ. So all you have to do is send an email into Thelema Coast to Coast. Use the address podcast at Thelema Coast to Coast. Put the Accidental Christ or a free book giveaway, something to let me know what the email is about. Put that in the subject and put your address in there, your mailing address, and one lucky winner will receive a copy signed and sent directly from Lon Duquette. So don't miss that opportunity to get a free copy of his book. So that about does it for Thelema Coast to Coast number 39. Thanks for everyone for listening. The closing music is again from Lon Duquette. He has an album of a number of songs that he's written and play acoustically. This one is called I Love to Get Drunk in the Car. So I hope you enjoy that and stick around for the next podcast. Love is the law, love under will.
They say that drinking and driving, it's a very big curse. As felonies go, it's one of the worst. They say that drinking and driving brings misery and pain. But a guy needs a hobby to keep going insane. I love to get drunk in the car. I love to get drunk in the car. Every night around six, I slug down that sweet whiskey. I love to get drunk in the car. It's a good thing I don't live too far from my job, 'cause I drink in the car. Down the back streets I slink and I sing as I drink. I love to get drunk in the car. No, I don't like to drink in a bar. The urinals stink in a bar. I would much rather cruise in the fresh air and booze. I don't like to drink in a bar. Sometimes I light up a cigar and I smoke while I drink in the car. I can spit in the street. Jesus, Jesus, isn't life sweet? I love to get drunk in the car. Yes, I do. I love to get drunk in a car. I love to get drunk in a car. Every night around six, I slug down that sweet whiskey. I love to get drunk in a car. Each night as I drink in the car, I look up and wish on a star and give thanks to the gods. I keep beating the odds, 'cause I love to get drunk in the car. I love to get drunk in the car. I love to get drunk in the car. Every night around six, I slug down that sweet whiskey. I love to get drunk in the car.